Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Ever heard the story of the Scopes monkey trial? Chances are, if you have, it went something like this. After courageously telling his students about evolution, science teacher John Scopes was arrested, jailed, and prosecuted by an angry town of religious fundamentalists who wanted to make Darwin's theory illegal and hoped that Darwin's supporters would burn in hell. Those who supported Scopes were committed to free speech and good science, while politician William Jennings Bryan, who supported the prosecution, was a scientifically illiterate young Earth creationist who made a buffoon of himself. Sound familiar? It turns out that almost everything you just heard is wrong. This fake picture of the past originated not with the actual Scopes trial, but with the Scopes trial's fictional portrayal in Inherit the Wind, the popular stage play and film that continues to seriously distort our view of the debate over evolution. This is John West for ID the Future. Today you get to listen in on the second part of my conversation with filmmaker Fred Foote, creator of the film Alleged, which tries to tell a more truthful version of the famous trial of John Scopes. My discussion with Fred took place on the set of Alleged in between scenes as it was being filmed. Last time, Fred talked about how he was inspired to create a new dramatic film about the Scopes trial after watching Inherit the Wind and learning that its depiction was almost the opposite of the truth. In today's segment, we talk about some of the biggest myths about the Scopes trial that Fred hopes his film will correct. So what are some of the, let's maybe name some of the biggest myths from Inherit the Wind that your film sort of portrays something differently?
Yeah. All right. And it's a very subtle portrayal, too. I don't want to give people the impression that they'll get a history lesson. They won't. They'll just see a trial, a romance, and that they'll laugh and cry at, hopefully. But in a very subtle way, it comes out, for instance, that the Tennessee law was not an anti-evolution law. It's just how it's described and even reported in today in the New York Times. If you read an article about the Scopes monkey trial, they'll say in 1925, the state of Tennessee passed a law which prohibited the teaching of evolution in the public schools. Except that that's entirely wrong. There's 2 million plant and animal species on Earth, not to mention the solar system, not to mention the cosmos or anything else that could be taught as having evolved in the state of Tennessee. You could only teach in the Tennessee that 1 out of 2 million species they had to remain silent about, and that's the evolution of mankind from a lower order of animal. So if it's an anti-evolution statute, it got 1/2 millionth of the goal. So it clearly is not an anti-evolution.
Okay. So it was a lot more nuanced than that. Now, what about and so that certainly is one of the myths coming out of the trial, that statute made it a crime to teach anything about evolution.
Absolutely.
So the law itself was something different. And then what about this whole, I know Inherit the Wind, you have John Scopes character, he's jailed, and people really, there's a fanatical minister who is stirring up people to try to intimidate him. And, you know, it's just sort of like the Salem witch trial set in the 1920s. And was that accurate?
No, it couldn't be farther from the truth. John Scopes was recruited to participate in the trial, which he did willingly, even though he never taught evolution. He was game to say that, yes, he substituted in a biology class that had as its text a book that presented evolution of mankind. But Scopes was a guy that was willing to participate in a scheme to bring business to Dayton. And it was a fun and lighthearted and successful scheme to bring business to Dayton. I mean, Dayton, Tennessee today is 15,000 people. It's got Bryan College. So this whole scheme to put the town on the map worked in a delightful, fun, and cool way. Inherit the Wind portrays it as a mean-spirited pastors with an axe to grind because some little boy, you know, died without a baptism and said, you know, went to hell and all this stuff. And it just wasn't religiously motivated.
And it wasn't hatched in the church. It was hatched in
a drugstore. Yeah, hatched in a drugstore. And people appreciated and loved Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan for coming to their town. Okay. And I think we can appreciate that. You would love a big debate in your town. Mm-hmm. So Darrow was warmly welcomed. In the trial transcripts, he goes at length how he's never been treated better by any group of people with whom he had such great ideological differences. So,
and you mentioned William James Bryan, who of course is one of the dominant characters of that whole period, but also of the trial. And of course that is another sort of icon or myth of this trial, which is here's the big buffoon, the Jerry Falwell prototype, this Christian conservative right-wing guy who was trying to help fan the flames of intolerance and sort of a demagogue. Was that true? And how?
I think maybe of all the characters in American history that have been unfairly treated, William Jennings Bryan would have to be up there near the top, especially from his own supporters. Clarence Darrow voted for William Jennings Bryan because the man was very, very left-leaning politically. So great advocate for labor, for the silver, which would help debtors, for the elimination of the gold system, for women's rights. Very progressive, very left-leaning, all these things. So the left in general loved this man. But his fatal flaw was a belief in the miracles of the Bible. And not even the wooden, literal, you know, fundamentalism that he's accused of. He was not a six-day young earth creationist, so he doesn't even fit the Bible-believing...
The old age of the earth and the universe, and that's how he read Genesis.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, he get, and of course, a brilliant man, a great orator, a great teacher, newspaper editor, author, statesman, three-time candidate for the Democratic Party for president, I think the youngest ever, just an amazing man who is completely obliterated and erased from the liberal hagiography because he was a Bible believer. That was his big sin.
This having been able to read your script and see some of the filming, I think it's just terrific how you present him as a much more nuanced character that's much truer to the historical record. And, of course, one of the real exciting things is who you cast, which is Fred Thompson, who is great thing of sort of for people who are history buffs. Here you have someone who himself was a United States senator who ran for president, and he's playing someone who was a famous United States senator who ran actually repeatedly for president and didn't quite make it with William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah, very
so
charismatic.
How that worked out?
Senator Fred Thompson has just been fantastic. He's got that big presence, that big voice, the big personality, the intelligence, the thoughtfulness of a William Jennings Bryan. He happens to be a physical, you know, dead ringer for Bryan, so that's fun. And there's even a Tennessee link. Fred Thompson was senator from Tennessee, and this trial took place in Tennessee, so he gets the accents, at least of the locals, right. So he's been great, and then he's playing opposite Brian Dennehy, which is arguably one of the greatest stage actors in America alive today.
And Dennehy, I understand, is not a stranger to this whole story.
That's right. On Broadway, Dennehy played William Jennings Bryan or...
character in,
yes,
in Inherit the Wind.
Matthew Harrison Brady.
Yeah, Matthew Harrison Brady.
So, yeah, and Brian Dennehy is... fantastic. Colm Meaney, an Irish actor, is playing H.L. Mencken without the brogue, and he's absolutely terrific, as well as Nathan West and Ashley Johnson. So I really think we're in for a visual treat.
Okay. Now, one of the other big themes coming out of Inherit the Wind is pitting science versus religion.
Yes.
That this whole debate was between the enlightened scientific community who were, you know, progressive, believed in human rights and liberation of the human mind versus the, you know, religious dark ages, the Inquisition, the forces of religious oppression of know-nothings, you know, in the backwaters of Tennessee.
Yeah.
Well, how does that play out in your film and how did that play out in reality? Is that an...
Well, this is my personal way of looking at that issue even now as then, is I don't think it's science versus religion. I think it's one set of scientific arguments against a second set of scientific arguments, and then one religious belief system versus a different religious belief system. Now, the materialists hate this, breaking it into a, say, quadrant, because... one, they are loath to acknowledge any scientific evidence against their position. So they don't want to acknowledge that there's another scientific case to be made. And the Discovery Institute makes careers out of bringing out that scientific case. So there is scientific opposition to undirected materialism. And then there is a religious component as well. There are religious implications to the fact that we have no purpose or no designer, and whether that's right or wrong to deny the religious implications of there being no God just seems foolish. So the evolutionists love to set up this dichotomy where they're in charge of the measurable, improvable, and repeatable, and the other side gets who can say what's right or wrong. And that works very well for them, but it's highly inaccurate.
And actually, you can have a form of, among some of the scientists, of a sort of Darwinian fundamentalism. I know that sort of played out in the 1920s. Why don't you talk a little bit about, although this your film is about the Scopes trial, there's also sort of a companion plot that's fictional but drawn from actually the history of the time. What is that about, and how does that sort of shed light on some of the more complexities of some of the interactions between science and culture?
Yeah. Well, we mentioned that the statute is not an anti-evolution statute, or if it is, it's the worst one ever written. So what it really directed itself towards was the practice of eugenics in the United States in the 1920s or even before. And So that's one example that if man is not in some way connected with a higher purpose, then man is an animal, and the scientific world began to say, well, if man is an animal, let's get down to the business of making a better animal. And we do it with dogs, and we do it with horses and pigs, and we make them fatter and better and cuter and whatever. So let's make better people, and let's not be sentimental about it or religious or traditional. Let's just buck up and look at the science. Well, what that looks like in 1920s America and in 1930s and 40s Germany is you decide who's more advanced than the others and you begin to cull the population.
Yeah. And they also made, it seems to me, Darwin himself warned about, by being charitable and counteracting natural selection, that we were sort of destroying the human gene pool. That's using modern language. And so they thought that at the very least we needed to reinstitute something like natural selection if we were going to counteract it. You know, if we're going to help the poor or the handicapped or others to survive those who would have died off in the wild, then we need to do something to make sure that they don't, you know, continue to propagate, and hence you have eugenics. And
that's so, right. Yeah. So in our storyline, there's a little girl who's happens to be a mulatto, this beautiful, talented little girl that's mulatto. And in the storyline, she is lined up to be sterilized because they figured out with measuring facial features and IQ tests that she doesn't possess.
Doesn't measure up.
She doesn't measure up. And in our storyline, she is, I won't say how it turns out, but
that's no spoilers.
No spoilers, but that's a very emotional and very, very relevant part to 1920s America. And not a part that you'll hear in Inherit the Wind. Mm-hmm. Because who wants to hear that the enlightened, open-minded, fair elitists of the day were really setting the stage for Nazi Germany?
And pushed forced sterilization in the United States at the time. And
that's right.
That's right. I think that might be shocking to most people. That you might, your film might spark some controversy on that.
Yeah, I hope so. To resurrect the reasonableness of the Tennessee citizens who opposed ranking, for instance, the races of mankind in order of biological superiority. That is offensive, I think, to everybody, and I don't even think the ACLU would go to the defense of a school board that wanted to teach kids in the class what race or what color was more advanced than another.
I mean, that's interesting because you're, I think, referencing to the actual textbook.
That's right.
John Scopes may have used. I guess there's some debate about whether he actually taught the lesson or not.
Right.
But he said that he used, that teaches about evolution, has a big section on what?
On eugenics and certain people being parasitical on the rest of the body, and then what you do with parasites is you eliminate them.
And then white Caucasians being sort of at the top of the human race structure.
Yeah. And if you look at some of the earlier diagrams of Ernst Haeckel, who did the famous embryo diagrams, he illustrates the evolution of mankind, and there is an unmistakably Jewish figure. Mm. So you go back to something that looks like a baboon, and then you get into something that looks, unmistakably Semitic, and then you go through something that looks more African, and then Eurasian or Asian, and then, up into this Roman good German prototype. And so the anti-Semitism, the racism, all, This can't be compared in my mind. KKK say, let's say they hate people that aren't their color. All right, that's despicable. But I'll say, tell you something more despicable than that black people are inferior, and that is that black people are inferior by 1.5 million years or 2.5 million years, and that has the scientific imprimatur of, say, Harvard or Columbia. That really puts an entire group of people in a helplessly, you know...
That sort of scientific justification or pseudoscientific justification for racism actually helped reinforce groups like the KKK, saying that now we have the mantle of modern science. I remember reading books from the era where people actually said that. You know, said, well, we have to believe in racial inferiority because that's what Darwinian science tells us, because natural selection leads to different characteristics among different races, and some, you know, races are basically back in the Stone Age, where others are, you know, higher in evolutionary development. And that was in the Scopes textbook, that Hunter's civic biology, which the great irony is today that many of the people who or like the ACLU, who are big on this issue, think Scopes is a hero. Today, if you had a teacher trying to teach out of that textbook, they would be probably really would be driven out of town because of some of the really horrifying things it says on racial issues, promoting eugenics, in that whole section on evolution. And it's sort of tied in. It's not, you know, it's in that section.
If you've been interested in this discussion, I hope you will join us for the third and final installment of my interview with writer and producer Fred Foote, when we'll discuss what it took to recreate one of the most famous trials in American history on screen. You can get more information about this movie at allegedthemovie.com, and you can order the film at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other retailers. For ID the Future, this is John West. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.